It's time for Valley Writers Read, a production of Valley Public Radio featuring the talents of writers from Central California. Here's the host of our program, Franz Weinschenk.
Good evening, friends. Welcome to another edition of Valley Writers Read. Our writer reader tonight is James Ashford, who will be reading his story entitled Country Roads.
On the last day of his ordinary life, Tom Carson signed for a FedEx letter from the Fresno law firm of Loot, Pillage, and Burn. He hefted the packet, imagining the firm's grand office and the size of its partner's shares compared to his solo practice in a strip mall in Los Angeles. Expecting the worst, a lawsuit against one of his few and mostly unpaying clients, or, God forbid, against him, he hesitated, then opened the packet and shook it. A folded letter slipped out, then a small envelope with something bulky and heavy inside. He studied the letterhead, recognizing the names of two of his classmates from law school who were partners in the Fresno firm. Tom groaned in envy and scanned down the text, expecting the usual insulting lawyer's boilerplate, officious claims of grievous injury and pain and suffering and irreparable damages. He was surprised to discover that he was being addressed as a person, not as an economic target. "Mr. Carson," the letter began, "in association with the firm of Vole and Ferret, Solicitors at Law, London, UK, we represent the estate of William Slard, late of Surrey." Tom's mind braked to a full stop. Billy Slard, from high school days in the valley. Skinny, awkward, all teeth and neck and ears and acne. Billy had suffered a cruel reputation with his classmates as a weirdo because of his preoccupation with magic, ESP, UFOs, time travel, witchcraft, every kind of fantastic or paranormal or occult baloney he could reference in the public library. After their sophomore English class had read Tennyson's Idylls of the King, everyone took to calling Billy Merlin. In today's high school, he would have been reviled as a Satanist by the religiously righteous, but probably also elected student body president. Times had changed. In those days, the unforgiving small-town 1950s, he was just dismissed as a geek. Because of his skinniness and awkwardness and weirdness, and also because he was without question the brightest guy in the school, Billy had been the butt of bullies. Tom, alone of all the conventional and conforming kids, had liked Billy Slard, and they'd kept a friendship through high school. Billy talked only about magic and the impossible. Tom talked only about cars, especially Fords, and girls, one especially. Each pretended an interest in the other's obsessions. They got along just fine. Tom's eyes lingered on the phrase, "William Slard, late of Surrey." "Ah, Merlin," he thought, "my young friend, my own age." The letter continued, "As you are perhaps not aware, Mr. Slard had accumulated considerable wealth in his lifetime." Tom's jaw dropped. "And while he had no heirs, we are advised by the solicitors at Vole and Ferret that he was most generous in his will to what we deem to be obscure and, frankly, unusual causes and charities. As for yourself, we are instructed to inform you that Mr. Slard made you a testamentary gift of what the dispository instrument refers to as a magical machine." The letter from Loot, Pillage, and Burn then seemed to stare down its nose, sniff, and conclude. "You may claim this machine, whatever it is, at the following address." One of Tom's former classmates had written a note at the bottom of the letter. "Hey, Carson, what kind of freaks did you hang around with? Maybe you could have used some magic in law school." There was a map of an area east of Fresno, but Tom knew he wouldn't need it. He remembered where Billy's folks had kept a small ranch, mostly tree fruit, some grapes. It was way out in the country, down in the Kings River bottomland, past where the kids from town would drive to park and drink beer and fool around. Tom remembered that place, too, and his 50 Ford coupe and Lucky Lager beer. But most of all, he remembered Mary Lou Fairlane. He remembered her a lot. Tom recalled the last time he'd talked to Billy. It was graduation day, and he'd heard some shouting in the boys' bathroom on the second floor and had gone in, and there was Big John Hood and his oafish buddy, Piggy Fender, the premier ditchbank thugs of the school, tag-teaming Billy. The skinny kid was backed into a corner, and the toughs were bouncing him against the tiles like a basketball. Tom clipped them at the knees, and they went down. Then he'd punched them both a couple of times, and the fight was over. The bullies ran out of the bathroom, gasping bully threats, and Tom had pulled Billy up from the floor. "Happy graduation day, Merlin," Tom had said, and Billy Slard smiled. "You've been good to me, Tom," the boy said. "I won't forget." And they'd waved at each other in the graduation line that night, and the next day Tom had gone to YMCA camp up at Sequoia Lake, and when he got back to town, Billy was gone, back to school in the East somewhere. Tom went off to college, too, and there were some letters back and forth, and then, as it happens, the everlasting friendship of youth was replaced by new friendships, and they'd lost touch. Tom slit open the small envelope. A huge medieval-looking key thudded onto his desk. There was a tattered paper tag tied to the key with clumsily pencil script that said only, "Barn." Tom checked his appointment calendar, knowing that there were always more blank spaces than appointments, and decided he might as well make it up to the valley the next day. Maybe make a long weekend of it, see the old places. A little nostalgia couldn't hurt him. An unseemly number of soured relationships, too long in the L.A. rat race, a going-nowhere law practice, and a profound and growing sense of self-worthlessness hadn't left him much to remember with fondness. He stuffed the letter and the key in his jacket, checked out with his answering service, and left his empty office to go to his empty apartment. When Tom walked out of the Fresno air terminal, the hot August night slapped him in the face as would a betrayed lover, and then embraced him in forgiveness. He sucked in a breath. It was the valley, all right. Odorous suggestions of irrigation ditches, pastures, grapes, fruit trees, milkweed. Tom checked out his Avis rental and drove to the airport Holiday Inn. After a drink in the bar, he went to his room and slipped into bed. The air conditioner hummed and cycled until Tom got up and shut it off and opened the window to keep the valley night with him. He fell into a long sleep. He dreamed of youth and friends and Fords. He dreamed of Mary Lou Fairlane. Late the next morning, Tom turned the rental car out onto Clinton and headed east. He clicked on the radio. At the bottom of the FM band, there was an NPR affiliate that featured earnest news and caring commentary, classical music, and, of course, pledge drives. Then, as he cruised the digits upward, stations offered soft rock, hard rock, heavy metal, oldies, country, Latino, and religion, lots of religion. On AM, there was a sports station, and more soft and hard and metal rock and Latino, and more religion. And, as he'd expected, ubiquitous and loathsome talk radio. He tried the strongest station at the bottom of the AM band, KMJ 580, listened for a minute, then switched off in sorrow that what he remembered from his youth as the venerable NBC affiliate and flagship station for the Valley's news and culture had become a horn for the ravings of Rush Limbaugh. Tom cruised through the vineyards and orchards toward the foothills. The car ran smoothly and effortlessly, separating him from the sound and feel of the road and the rush of the wind, as all cars did now. He glanced at a medallion on the dash. It said Chevrolet. And he realized that until then he'd had no idea of the make of the car he was driving. It was plastic and generic, just another car. Laws that had mandated minimum gas mileage had made automotive travel both efficient and devoid of excitement. All cars had to meet minimum standards of fuel consumption, which involved factoring not only mechanical efficiency, but also wind resistance. Since the laws of physics could not be repealed, the result of decades of environmental concern was that all cars on the American road were aerodynamically correct and blandly the same in appearance. And, Tom thought, they were all mostly shades of white. To anyone who'd lived and driven in the 50s, they looked as alike and exciting as so many loaves of Wonder Bread. He dropped off the bluff and into the bottomlands. Another few miles and turns, and he came to a rusted mailbox at a dirt driveway. He checked the faded name, Slard, and turned slowly in and drove through a weed-filled orchard of sickly-looking peach trees that hadn't been pruned for years. The dirt road opened onto a large empty yard. There was a weathered frame house with a screened porch, a listing tank house, and at the back of the property, a half-collapsed barn. He wheeled the Chevrolet to park by the barn. And then, as if he'd run into a wall, the transmission locked up. The airbags blew, and there was an explosion from the engine. Smoke poured out from under the hood. The tires blew in quick succession. The wheels came off the axles. And with a low metallic groan, the Chevy settled to the ground like a gut-shot rhinoceros. Panicked and cursing, Tom pressed the airbag back onto the steering wheel, opened the door, and slid onto his hands and knees in the dirt. He crawled quickly away from the car, looking over his shoulder in disbelief as the bumpers fell off. The rear deck popped open and sprung. The spare tire blew. The hood swept up, detached from its hinges, and crashed back onto the roof. And the side and back windows cracked and shattered. For what Tom later thought to be a touching moment, the windshield wipers swept madly back and forth as if waving goodbye. Then the windshield disintegrated. He stood up, marveling at the Chevy's agony. The driver's side door fell off, then the passenger's side door. Tom walked warily around the destructing car to the sound of more shearing metal and clanks and thuds. He stumbled back and turned to run toward the house. At his back, he felt the concussion of igniting gasoline and the heat of a spreading fire. Finally, over the sound of crackling flames, he heard the Chevy's horn give a last post, two short bleeps and one long and dying croak. Tom stepped up to the porch, dusting the dirt from his pants, and knocked on the screen door, waited, knocked again. He listened for noises from inside the house. He pulled on the screen door and it opened onto the porch. He stepped to an entry door of the house, knocked, waited, knocked again. "Hello," he shouted. "Hello, anyone home?" There was no answer. He moved to a window next to the door and pressed his hands and face to the glass. No furniture, no rugs. He walked along the porch to another window and looked into another empty room. He walked around the corner of the porch and came to a window door to a kitchen that had no stove, no refrigerator, no table or chairs. He pushed against the door and it swung open. He slipped inside. Minutes later, Tom stepped back into the sun. He'd walked through every room. The house was empty and filthy. It couldn't have been lived in for years. He took the big iron key from his pocket. Giving the burning Chevy a wide berth, he walked slowly across the yard to the barn. He hefted an ancient padlock, securing a massive rusted hasp and staple on the barn door, and pressed the key slowly into the lock and turned it. The lock opened, and Tom freed the hasp and slowly pushed the massive door along its tracks, brushing away thick cobwebs. Suddenly, a huge raven flew out the opening door, cawing wildly, and Tom jumped back in fright and looked up, following the bird as it rose into the bright summer sky until he lost it in the sun. Then he looked inside the barn, and time cracked open. In the center of the barn floor, glowing in filtered sunlight from the holes in the roof, was a 1956 Ford Thunderbird, blazing Fiesta red with a white top and wide white wall tires. Tom blinked in disbelief. He walked slowly to the car. He ran his fingers over the shiny trim on the grill, over the smooth fiberglass top and the chrome circle of the porthole windows. over the Thunderbird logo on the rear fin, over the rakish Continental tire mount on the rear. The car was spotless. In the middle of a deserted barn that was home to mice and rats and pigeons and sparrows and at least one very large raven, and parked on a thick layer of dust that covered everything else, the car was utterly clean, and it looked brand new. Well, of course, it couldn't be new. It must be restored, he thought. Restored to look as it had the day in 1956 when it had come off the Dearborn assembly line. He walked around the car to the driver's side door, slipped his fingers into the handle, pressed the chrome button. The lock clicked smoothly. Tom opened the door and settled himself onto the bench seat, then swung his feet into the interior. He breathed deeply. It even smelled like a new car. Tom ran his fingers over the dashboard, over the bright Thunderbird medallion, over the buttons of the belt-driven, signal-seeking town and country AM radio, cutting edge for its day, with the triangular icons on the dial for the Cold War Connell-Rad emergency frequencies of 640 and 1240. He caressed the black knob on the floor-mounted shifting column for the Fortimatic transmission. He looked at the bird's odometer. It registered zero. Well, he thought, of course, it's a completely rebuilt classic Thunderbird, and the odometer would be set back to zero, wouldn't it? Was that legal? Did it matter? He looked around the interior at the burnished dashboard trim and door side panels, the gleaming chrome of the windshield mounting and the latches for the removable hardtop. He stroked the bench seat's upholstery, two-tone red and white. He reached over to the glove compartment and pressed its latch. The door eased slowly open. At the front of the box, there was a leatherette pouch, and inside that, there was a pristine owner's manual, a set of shiny keys, and a current DMV pink slip and registration with his name and Los Angeles address. Tom sat for a very long time, his hands at 10 and 2 on the big red steering wheel, staring out along the bird's hood. Finally, he reached over to shut the glove compartment and saw a slip of paper at the back of the box. He pulled it out, turned it over. In pencil script, it read, "Tom, thanks for your friendship. Enjoy. Merlin." Tom whispered a thank you to Billy Slard, then took the slender ignition key and inserted it. He pressed the button on the shifting knob and moved the transmission into neutral. His memories of 50s Fords came back. Push the gas pedal all the way down, release it, wait a second, and turn the key. The four-barreled Holley carburetor delivered premium gasoline, and the 312 cubic inch V8 fired on the first crank, and a sensuous humming filled the barn. The generator and oil pressure lights blinked off. The tachometer on the left side of the dash held at a leisurely 700 RPM. The gas gauge inched up to full. The water temperature needle slowly climbed to the middle of the range. Tom released the parking brake with his left hand, and with his foot on the brake pedal, grasped the gear shift knob, depressed the chrome button at the top, and dropped the Fortimatic into drive. And so did Tom Carson take his 1956 Ford Thunderbird into the sunlight of a San Joaquin Valley summer, past the smoldering wreck of a 1999 Chevrolet, and to the country roads beyond. The Thunderbird purred along effortlessly. Tom relished the feel of the car, the compact interior, the long expanse of the fenders in front, and the gentle accent of the air intake on the hood, the mixture of smooth and angular lines that had said steel and style to another generation. There was little traffic ahead. Tom floored the accelerator. The Holley sucked air and gas, and the bird flew. In 5 seconds, he was doing 80, 85, 90, 95. He backed off, laughing. He wheeled into one of the little towns of the East Valley. There was one stoplight, and he caught it. And he heard shouts. A gorgeously buffed 69 Ford sedan was beside him. Four young guys were grinning at him, pumping their arms, whistling. "Man, great car! Trade you even?" Tom grinned, gave a thumbs up, and peeled out on the green light. Then he took the bird back into the country and up into the hills, past Squaw Valley, all the way to the turnoff to Sequoia Lake. He parked there, cut the engine, and got out to stretch. The engine manifold and pipes ticked in the cool mountain air. When he got back behind the wheel, he idly reached over and pushed the radio's on button. The dial glowed, the vacuum tubes heated up, the radio began to hum softly, and then an announcer, a strangely familiar voice, was saying, and referring to these developments in the Suez Crisis, President Eisenhower said that he was in contact with both British Prime Minister Anthony Eden and Egypt's President Abdel Nasser. This is David Brinkley, NBC Monitor Radio News. Much later in the mountain darkness, Tom sat numbly in the glow of the Thunderbird's radio, rolling the dial back and forth. For fine family dining, remember Rustigan's Iran Restaurant at Tulare and U. And Crest with Floristan, the new way to fight tooth decay. Summer specials at Roos Brothers at the corner of Fresno and Fulton. For your family's safety, the tire experts at Lamas and Smith. The Democrats begin their 1956 National Convention next week in Chicago. The party's frontrunners are Adlai Stevenson and Averill Harriman. Rodman Chevrolet, Mel Drummond Ford, Crockett Brothers, Slavich Brothers. This is Dean Mell, sitting in for Chet Castleman, with the news for Friday, August 3, 1956. That afternoon, Tom had looked under the Thunderbird's hood, under the dash, under the seat, in the trunk, in the door wells, the wheel wells, everywhere he could reach or see, searching for a tape deck or CD player or whatever might explain what he was hearing. He'd tried turning the radio off and on. He'd played with the button settings. He'd pounded his fists on the dashboard. He'd taken a very long walk down to the lake. He'd come back and driven the Thunderbird into Grant Grove and wandered through the big trees. Tom had nodded politely when people complimented him on the car. He was amused when he heard someone say, "I wonder what year it is." "You tell me," he thought. A 20-something in a BMW convertible, his sunglasses rakishly set on coiffed hair, had asked, "What is it?" And Tom found himself saying, "It's a time machine." Then he'd driven back to the turnoff for the lake, parked again, and watched the sunset. "What year is it?" he wondered. Then he turned the radio on again. "Well, folks, the Cards are leading the California League by 4 games, and this game by 1 run. And manager Eddie Lyons sure wants to keep both those leads, so he's going to the mound now, and there will be a new pitcher for Fresno." You're listening to Fresno Cardinals Baseball on Radio KYNO 1300 on your AM dial. "Merlin," Tom thought, "what have you done to me?" Finally, Tom eased onto the highway to begin a slow descent back into the valley. He pulled into the hotel parking lot at 11 to the musical theme for Stan's Private Line on KMJ, "I'm in the Mood for Food." He sat in the Thunderbird just long enough to remember the storied drive-in's deep dish apple pies with whipped cream, and until the first song dedication came up. More than 25 teenage frums and twos for Elvis's new hit, "Love Me Tender." Tom turned the radio off and went to the bar. Then, appropriately medicated, he went to his room and called the Avis people. "Car trouble?" the clerk asked. "You don't know the half of it," Tom said. In the morning, he found a number for a local Thunderbird owners club and from them got the name of a T-Bird restoration specialist north of town. "Nice bird," the specialist said when Tom drove up. "How long you had her?" "Just got her. Friend died. Left it to me," Tom said. "You think I'm a lucky man?" "Sorry about your friend," the specialist said, "but you are lucky. It's a great-looking bird." The specialist began to look the car over. At first, his examination was perfunctory. Then he began spending more and more time staring at particular parts of the car. Then he became obsessive, crawling under the dash, under the car, under the hood, into the trunk. Finally, the specialist surfaced. He shrugged and went into his office. In a moment, he was back with a loose-leaf manual under his arm. The specialist cleared his throat. I'm confused. I'm not sure what I'm seeing here. He held out the manual. According to Ford records, the company produced 15,361 of the 56 model Thunderbirds. But the unit number on the serial plate of this car says that this is car number 15,362. Well, Tom said hesitantly, the serial plate could be bogus, changed. Yeah, but there's more. Look, I've been restoring classic Thunderbirds for 25 years. I've won best of show more times than I can count. I know these cars. And I tell you, I don't think this car has been restored. A complete frame-up restoration, like you might think this one looks to be, is always a better car than the factory product. It's a matter of time and economics. This car sold for about $3,500 in 1956. Ford Motor Company couldn't have afforded to make it as mechanically perfect as a present-day restored car would be. It would have cost them twice as much just to produce that kind of car. Your bird here, I look at the things that a quality restoration job actually improves from the original machine. Door fit, trim, interior trunk and hood details, paint, especially the paint, and they haven't been done here. I think this Thunderbird is a production model, period. He paused. But that's not the strangest part. I know that even if you took a new car and hermetically stored it, you know, sealed it in some sort of tank or something with inert gas and all that, well, that still wouldn't stop some kinds of aging. Look, time itself deteriorates things, breaks them down like seals, hoses, rubber moldings, things like that. Know what I mean? Well, I don't see any deterioration like that here. So you see, I think this bird is not a 45-year-old car. It's a new car. Listen, the specialist said very quietly now. This sounds crazy, but listen. See this number here on the serial plate? Well, my friend, this number is a production date code, and according to this code, your car was made yesterday. The specialist stared at Tom, and Tom stared back. Yeah, well, Tom fumbled, if you think that's weird, listen to this. He turned on the radio, KMJ. Rush Limbaugh was raving. His callers were raving back. Boy, I can't stand that guy, the specialist said. But it's good reception, even on that old, that radio. Listen, do you have some time? I mean, can we talk about this bird some more? Well, Tom said, I do have to go. Maybe later, but thanks for your help, and here's my card. He left the specialist flipping through the Ford manual. He drove slowly out of the driveway, and when he reached the road, Rush Limbaugh's voice faded, and NBC Monitor News Radio came on, as it always had on Saturdays in 1956. Tom drove back to town. On the way, he switched the radio to KFRE 940. The inimitable Al Radka was in the middle of his Saturday gay ride, spinning records and pretending to visit his sponsoring Fresno merchants. Radka was wondering at the moment whether he and his imaginary radio companion, Mrs. Winterbottom, should go for lunch to Estrada's Spanish Kitchen or to the Leilani, both on North Blackstone, or maybe to Fred Boyd's High Life on North Moroa. And what about the new rendezvous at Van Ness and Belmont? Tom drove around Fresno that day, stopping now and then, always drawing a crowd. He left the radio on all day. Whenever anyone except himself was in hearing range, Rush or his ditto heads or hip-hop or heavy metal sounded forth. When Tom was by himself, cruising up Blackstone or Van Ness or Fresno or First or Cedar, it was Monitor Radio, or Radka, or ads for Herman Theroff Pontiac, Bruckner's, The DeMarquis Restaurant, Harry Coffees, Frank J. Sanders, P.J. Eads, all once, all gone now. Tom stayed in the Bird until past midnight, listening. He'd tuned again to Stan's private line, and as the show rolled toward 2 in the morning, he realized that he'd been waiting, as he'd waited years before at that time, for a particular song, a particular dedication. Then, just before 2 a.m. And here's the last dedication of the night, to Tommy Carson and his 56 T-Bird, wherever you are, from someone who will always love you, Mary Lou. Hey, isn't that sweet, folks? So to Tommy and his brand new T-Bird, from his everlasting love, here's the Platters, My Prayer.
When the twilight is gone,
ah,
and no songbirds are singing,
ah,
when the twilight is gone,
ah,
you come into my heart,
ah,
and here in my heart you will stay. While I pray.
Oh my God, it was her.
My prayer.
Mary Lou Fairlane, our song, She to Me. They dedicated it back and forth 20 times that summer. And she was out there. But she couldn't be. Yes, she was. His brain on fire, Tom turned onto Belmont toward the house he'd been to so many times before. This is insanity, he thought. I'm a failed old man, and I'm acting like a teenager with his life ahead of him. And his youth punched the accelerator and pushed the Bird up through the numbers. 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. In time, he saw the farmhouse ahead, and he turned slowly into a long driveway through a familiar row of orange trees until he came to the house. Everything was dark, except for a light in an upstairs window. He turned off his headlights and engine and got out and looked up at the window, and he saw her, Mary Lou. She was sitting at her desk in the glow of a lamp, her hair just that way, that red sweater, the glasses. Oh, my God, Mary Lou! He fell back against the Thunderbird's fender. Mary Lou looked up and out the window at him and smiled and waved and mouthed, I love you, Tommy. Then he felt a rush of wings, and the yard was blasted with light and a screen door slammed. A big man in a worn terrycloth bathrobe walked cautiously but firmly toward Tom and the Thunderbird. Problem here? No, I was just... Tom looked at the upstairs window. It was dark. I was just driving, and I guess I got turned around. I used to live in town, you know, used to, some time ago. Long time ago, actually. The big man said, nodding, looking at Tom and the Thunderbird. Need some directions? No, I think I got it now. Say, isn't this the Fairlane place? The big man shrugged. Was, yeah. I bought it off Mr. Fairlane back in 82. The big man brushed back a sleep-mashed head of gray hair. Say, that's a real sharp car. Different. Darn, I did love them birds. They should have kept making them. The big man and Tom talked cars for a while, Tom's eyes looking up from time to time to the dark window on the second floor. Well, I guess I'll be going. I'm really sorry to have bothered you this late and all, Tom said. He shook the man's hand and got back into the Bird. He started the engine, and the big man said, real nice. And Tom said, thanks. And say, how do you like this place here? Plenty of room for a family, kids? Oh, well, the big man said. It's just me now. My wife, God bless, died a couple of years ago, and the boys are long gone, off to their own lives. That's how it goes, I guess. Just me now. The man looked about the yard. Then he turned to look to the house. He grinned. A good house. A good life. Could have been worse. I don't regret. He paused, blinked. Say, you take care with that Thunderbird, you hear? Tom nodded, smiled. He turned the bird around in the yard, waved at the big man, and cruised slowly out the driveway. When he stopped at the end, about to turn back to Fresno, the glove compartment door slowly opened by itself. There was a piece of paper sitting on top of the manual and registration papers. He turned on the map light on the dash and held the paper up, squinting at the penciled words. Tom, my friend, even magic has its limits. Get on with your life. Tom smiled, nodded, and turned onto Belmont and headed west. Tomorrow he'd go back to L.A. He had a new car. Maybe he had a new life. The rest of his life, anyway. He'd try it out. He didn't turn on the radio again until the next morning, just as he edged into traffic on Highway 99. With the Thunderbird at a steady 60, he tuned in KMJ and listened for a minute or two while Rush Limbaugh raved on. Then he switched the radio off and drove south, with only the sound and feel of the road and the rush of the wind, waving now and then to the cars and trucks that honked in salute to his magical machine.
That was Jim Ashford reading a rather amazing story entitled Country Roads, so that after listening to his story tonight, we might well ask ourselves, did all this really happen? Did Tom Carson really get a brand new Ford Mustang? Or was most or all of what we heard just going on in his mind? The author took us back to Tom Carson's high school days and his friendship with Billy Slard, whom the kids called Merlin because he always seemed to be involved with magic and sorcery. Tom remembers defending Billy against some high school bullies, and in gratitude, Billy, who has since passed away, left Tom a time machine in the form of a 1956 Ford Thunderbird. And what's fascinating, at least for us older folks who've lived in Fresno for a while, is that when you tuned into that Thunderbird's radio, you got what came over the air around the mid-50s. Al Ratka and Mrs. Winterbottom, the Fresno Cardinals over KYNO, and ads for Roos Brothers on Fresno and Fulton Streets. That is, before Fulton became a mall. And when Tom listened late into the night, what do you know? A song dedicated to him by Mary Lou Fairlane, his long-lost girlfriend. He even drove over and visited the house where she used to live, even thought he saw her in an upstairs window, at which point we say to ourselves, hold on now, things like that just don't happen. It's all imaginary, all in the mind of a man who wants to return to his youth. The man has lost his sense of reality. He's just dreaming and wishful thinking, isn't he? Well, we'll let you answer that question. Thank you, Jim Ashford, for such an intriguing story. Friends, Jim Ashford has been a longtime contributor and avid supporter of Valley Writers Read. He was born in Sanger and graduated from the University of California at Berkeley, where he received his law degree. He retired just a few years ago after having worked as an attorney for our own California legislature in Sacramento for over 30 years. Nowadays, he does a lot of traveling, writes travel essays and short stories. Thanks again, Jim Ashford, for your wonderful story tonight. Hope you've got more great fiction for us in seasons to come. And so we come to the close of another segment of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just get online at kvpr.org and link up with Valley Writers Read. Next week, our author will be Mark Arax. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.